The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Celebrate love with a special gift.
15 minutes past 8 here this Wednesday morning. Delighted to say UCD professor and examiner columnist Paul Wright is going to join us in studio next here on OTB AM. We're going to talk about Tom Ryan. Let's hear from the Director General. Here he is chatting to John Duggan after the release of his annual report about his desire to be more transparent regarding executive pay in the GAA.
There's a lot of talk in Irish sporting discourse about governance at the moment. We had the issues with the FAI. I think there's a very transparent, clear message from the GAA today about where the money's going, where the money's spent, like that is all put back into the association. Do you think or do you intend to publish the salaries of senior staff at the GAA, Tom?
Well, we have actually done that, John. If you have a look through the accounts, you'll see we didn't up to now. We never had any kind of disclosure like that in our accounts before, and certainly we never refer to individuals or anything like that. This year, what we've done is we have identified and disclosed in aggregate the salaries of, I suppose, what you would call the senior management group. So that's a bit of a departure for us. But again, we haven't mentioned individuals. But look, what we've got in the accounts there, I think it's in excess of what we would be required to provide in terms of accounting standards and accounting in terms of the law and so on, all those things. We're conscious of those standards. We're conscious of preparing accounts that are meaningful to users, and they are actually able to get a good handle on what it costs to run the association. So we have expanded on our disclosures this year.
You enjoying the job, Tom? What's your hope for 2020 in Gaelic Games?
Big thing for 2020, I would love to see the fixtures issue making progress. I think the amount of work that went into that over the course of the last 3 to 6 months was phenomenal. And I think if we can arrive at some really, really good changes arising out of that piece of work towards the end of the year, I think that'll be good. And as always, my hope for the year is good matches.
Tom Ryan speaking with John Duggan yesterday at the launch of his annual report. Paul Rouse is here. Paul, let's start with the executive pay because we just played that clip and people will be interested in it. They didn't have to do it, but they did have to do it in a way because that's where we are as a society at the moment, particularly given everything that's done. But fair play to them for coming out. This feels like there's baby steps in the right direction here and towards a more transparent organisation.
This is, I would see it as a landmark report. In the manner in which the GAA conducts its affairs. It's the tone of the report, the content, the manner in which it's organised, the absence of hubris, the acknowledgement of difficulties, and remarkably, a clearly set out vision for what the association should be, succinctly put in half a page rather than the product of a commission's strategic report with external consultants that costs a bomb and nobody reads. I think the whole thing is it's a credit to Tom Ryan and it's a credit to the association. It's not to say that there aren't a couple of problems within the report, but I think it's what you would, if you were a GAA member, it strikes exactly the right tone and has exactly the right content for what you might wish to see.
That's the most positive thing I've ever heard anybody say about an annual report from the GAA.
And you know, it's great to be able to say something positive.
Yeah.
About the manner in which the GAA is run at central level. Now, it's not that there aren't things that need to be done. It's not that there aren't gaps in it, and it's not that there's a clear and absolute definitive plan. The devil will be in the detail in the workings out, but as a document which sets out how the organisation is conducting itself, what it needs to do to fix problems and where it needs to go, I think it's what you look for.
You can't solve a problem if you can't diagnose it and it's clear. So in a way, like Tom Ryan obviously inherited this gig and there were a number of squalls that kind of blew through the association over the last period of time. This is him now getting to grips with it. This is his organisation. That's his senior management team. This is him properly feet under the table as the person who has the main gig as opposed to just the person who was the finance guy.
Yes.
So this is his first, like obviously, this isn't his first annual report, but it's certainly his first time where he's been able to go, okay, my committees have been in place. I've worked with a president for a couple of years now. I've had this role. to the point where I can begin to expand what my vision is. So let's start with that, because that's very interesting to hear you say that.
Finally, there's a confidence about it as well. I mean, he's and I want to say this clearly. I don't know Tom Ryan. I met him very briefly once at a committee. I didn't ever have a conversation with him. And so I don't have a dog in the fight here, in the sense that I'm not given to him or in any shape or form. But you have to judge it by what you see and by the words that are written and by he lays out. And if you want to start with, he has a page which is 66 pages into the report, which is a logical follow-on of everything that he said before, and he maps it out clearly, what his vision of what the GAA should be. And I can point out a couple of
things. Yeah, let's talk about this. So this the page is a sustainable GAA.
It's called the sustainable GAA, and he sets out 8 points of how he sees the future. Number one, the year is demarcated more clearly with defined rest periods. Number two, the burden on county players' time is lessened with a lower proportion of training to games. Number three, county players play much more regularly for their clubs. Number four, clubs are self-sustaining in that team managers and coaches will come from within a club. Number five, that lessens the financial burden on clubs, which anyone who's involved in a club or in a county understands. All of that lessens the club and the county financial burden. It is hell to be involved as an officer in a club or in a county board at the moment to try and generate finances for the day-to-day operation of that organisation, let alone for capital investment for the future. Number six, the central pressure to drive money is lessened because all of that happens. So therefore, we don't have to squeeze everybody for every penny when it comes to everything else. Number seven, we have better organisational structures. So we have a supported officer base that means it doesn't take over your life if you organise this. And number eight, the burden on volunteers who run clubs and run counties is lessened, and therefore you can actually enjoy it a little bit more. So I think there's one gap in that list of eight, and he alluded to it in his comments there, where he talked about fixtures making progress. Mm. And that, from that I read, the production of a proper calendar of play for adult club players.
I feel like the defined rest periods is kind of
that's a code.
It is for fixtures.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it must include a coherent fixture, club fixtures for things. And in fairness, the new plan for a unit in Croke Park which will assist with this is something that we've been looking for years. So, and he's moving towards it after this Congress.
Is the new unit, sorry, I'm unfamiliar with that concept. So the new unit would be a body, like a full-time professional person who counties can ring up and say, help.
And the devil again will be in the detail in this, but it's also a way of auditing that counties are actually providing a proper fixture calendar for their club players.
Yeah. Because the headline stuff is executive pay, the debt in Porquequeave, the rampant expense that's out of control for running these county teams. They're all symptoms, right?
Yeah.
They're symptoms.
And these are the answers.
And of an organisation that hasn't, up to this point, had a, well, at our core, if we do these things, and we ask the question, does this help with our core business, or are we doing this according to our beliefs? And if the answer is no, then we don't do it. Like, do we have enough support for this infrastructural project in Porquequeave? The answer is no. Well, then we're not doing it until we actually put in place the right committees and structures and professional body.
And this is why I think the report is great, because it is undemonstrative in, and somewhat boring in the sense of those list of things that are fundamental. Eight pillars, fundamental pillars. And they're written in very simple English, very clearly put. And he then comes out with a line which says, to me, that's not revolutionary. Now, if he does those eight things, it will revolutionise the operation and the experience of GAA members around the country. If he does those eight things, if he leads, he can't do them himself.
Sure.
Like, if he leads the doing of those eight themes through a proper management structure in Croke Park, which isn't just a director general with a whole flat line of people under him who report directly to him. He needs a coherent management structure over it. He needs a sensible president with him who will assist in driving volunteers around the country in support of him. And if he does those things, this is revolutionary. He says it's not revolutionary, but it is in terms of how it will transform the association.
How achievable is it?
That is, again, this is the it's not going to be a revolution in the sense that we're going into the GPO and everything's going to be fine after April. That's not what this is. Like, the
we might have 100 years of difficulty in the aftermath.
There might be partition in the middle of this, but it will be done in stages if it's to be done. And you can see with Congress, with the new fixtures plans, you will see it in the proposals for new championships. But again, it's one thing to set this out. It's another thing to do it slowly. And you can see he's a way of doing things. For example, with rule changes in football and hurling, he talks about nudging the game, he's really talking about football, nudging the game in a more expansive direction. And I think what he's looking at here is nudging things in a very particular direction.
So, Paul, why do we then have a situation where, and I think fixtures are one of the most important things to be looked at the moment, especially when it comes to these eight facets of Tom Ryan's philosophy, why do we still have a situation where the CPA are looking at the fixtures being brought by Central Council and walking away? Why people who are inside the tent, even temporarily, are saying, no, we're not having this, we actually don't believe in the direction the organisation is going fixtures-wise? Like, I don't understand how that can tally, because, like, on the outside looking in, some of the new fixture proposals looked really good to me. They looked like they might fix calendar issues, whereas we've spoken to the CPA on the show and they've said that actually perhaps these sort of great fixture proposals may not actually meet their end point. They may not actually come to fruition because they might be out there for optics.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the CPA's position, which I have huge sympathy for, in fact, I agree with the CPA in their diagnosis of what's wrong. It's the product of decades, and in particular the last decade, but decades of neglect of club players. And it has created an anger, which is entirely justifiable and legitimate, about the way in which they've been treated. And again, I agree with that. But it is that thing about it being the art of the possible here. And you have to think about how change comes. If you come in with a vastly radical solution and insist on it being introduced now, I just don't see that happening. Mm. I think incremental movement is the only option here. And I don't see... look, this is fairly clear. You give this another 12 months. You give this... it's lined out in his report what he said, what he believes. You give it another 12 months to see demonstrable progress in a particular direction. The proposals from the fixtures committee are not an end in themselves. They can't be an end in themselves. Sure. They're not enough. But as a staging post, if they indicate a direction of travel, then I will take the best of those, right? Once they've been worked out. But it's not an end point. It has to be a direction of travel.
And I guess that has to take into account then the Tier 2 Championship as well, which obviously has been brought in under Tom Ryan's stewardship. Yeah. Like, obviously you can't attribute everything to the Director General when there are other people working in this, but it has happened under his watch. Like, if the Tier 2 situation is a Tommy Murphy situation again, like, does that not kind of make a huge problem of a few of these 8 points that he's made?
So I have two fundamental problems with the report, and I have a fundamental problem with the Tier 2 Championship, which I think is not a good proposal. I don't think it's well worked out. I don't think it's been properly thought through, and I don't think it fixes anything. So I fundamentally disagree with Tom Ryan on that. What I'm talking about here in this is the broad thrust of where he's going with the association.
Isn't the whole issue of Tier 2 the problem with the structures that we have in the GA, and that was the President's idea, and Tom Ryan can't say we're not doing it because actually the President brought it in, he was elected, and the Politburo can't say no, this is going to be a failure. They have to do their best to try and make a success of it.
And as we know, in any organisation which relies so heavily on volunteers, where there's a volunteer section meets a kind of a permanent civil service section, there is always tension. And working out the structure in that, nobody has cracked it on this one. It's a really difficult thing. It's a really difficult thing to work out. And again, I have yet to meet anybody, I've yet to meet anybody who thinks the Tier 2 proposal, as set out, is an end game in itself.
Yeah.
Or we fix anything.
Yeah, so I agree with you. But what if in 5 years' time we're looking back at what or 10 years time, we look back and go, what John Horan did was introduce the concept of Tier 2 to counties who up to that point had been, and players who were staunchly resistant of it. They fixed those structures when they flipped the seasons, and we now have a league in summer, and the championship is actually, the provincial championships are essentially the first competition of the year, and they're run off in a month, and then we've got 2 months of time for clubs to take over, and then there's this short league season which is 12 weeks and everybody goes, wow, that's amazing, and there's three divisions. Then the whole Tier 2 and Tier 3 thing was just a, it was a backdoor introduction to that. Everybody would be happy with some kind of solution around that, I think.
I've heard that argument, and I can see the logic of it. Personally, I don't think that people within the GAA are incapable of grasping the idea of a Tier 2 situation, and they don't need to see it made real in front of their eyes to understand.
Fair enough.
That it can be
introduced. We didn't need this.
We didn't need it.
We could have gone straight.
We came at this the wrong angle.
Yeah.
The stuff that needs to be done around calendar is much more important. The stuff that needs to be done around fixtures is much more important. The stuff that needs to be done around finance and organisation, they will allow the construction of other things, not the other way around.
You would say, in fairness to Tom Ryan, the whole point about the fixtures committee, which had the CPA in the tent, which had the GPA in the tent, was that they were getting there. In the meantime, the elected representatives were like, I need a Tier 2 championship, lads, let's go. And so that came in. It was almost like, really? We've got this little thing going on over here which might solve all our problems. Can we just wait and see how this goes? And it was like, no, we're getting Tier 2 now. So
I have a boring answer to that, and the boring answer is that I actually don't know what happens inside in Croke Park. I don't know if that's what the dynamic was. You may very well be right, but to me, it was the wrong way of doing it.
Yeah, okay.
Tom Ryan made a very valid point yesterday that these out-of-control inter-county costs are hampering other areas of expenditure within counties, yeah, in terms of coaching, in terms of grassroots.
Let me play the video of that, because actually that's interesting. He's here talking with John Duggan. Here is Tom Ryan talking about the level of spending by inter-county sides, saying it's unsustainable.
We haven't cracked that. There was a period 3 or 4 years ago when that cost appeared to be, if not coming down, at least appeared to be capped. It's increasing again. And it's not really sustainable. I mean, the sheer amount of pressure that it puts on counties financially is unsustainable, and the pressure it puts on county officers individually as volunteers to both bring in that funding, to make sure that funding is deployed to the best effect within counties. The sheer amount of stress, hassle, pressure that it puts on all of us is not sustainable. We need to address that.
Yeah, so like the point on the back of that being that, like, I always thought that, say, inter-county costs, they can run away as far as they want, and they are siphoned off, and it's actually a ridiculous notion. Of course, it's coming from other areas within county boards, and, like, the question is, how do you actually stop this? And Tom Ryan is the first person there to say that, I don't know, like, how do you stop this situation of, what is it, 32 million quid being spent in inter-county teams alone last year?
Now, if anybody believes there was only 32 million euros spent on inter-county teams last year, they have a relationship with finance, which I would love to see their personal bank accounts as a spectacular work of fiction. They must be. There was way more than 32 million spent on inter-county teams, and that's just in the current expenditure. Look at the capital expenditure for the infrastructure to allow the inter-county game generate the money, which is never included in this spend. So, for example, we have the headline figure of almost 100 million euros on Páirc Uí Chaoimh, with an outstanding debt of more than 20 million, which is never factored into the costs of the running of the inter-county game and everything around it. But what we're looking at here, of course, is opportunity cost as well, and the fact that if you spend money on one thing, you can't spend it on other things. Or if you invest time generating the money for this, you can't spend the time generating the ideas which will actually do the things that are needed to be done in each county. And again, boring point, but it comes down to calendar. Look at the amount of counties that were back training in October for pre-season competitions that began at the end of November, for a season that will end at the end of August for certain counties. Like, how, in what rational universe does that make sense? I mean, it makes sense if you are a person who is given to that and who has a job out of it and all of that, but that's a whole load of expense and time within an association which is devoted to something that is particular to the needs of a very small few. And that's not sustainable.
Every training session ends up costing a fortune because you've got to pay the nutritionist and you've got to pay all those professional staff who aren't the volunteers. For me,
can I tell you something on that? I want to tell you something. I was out in the National Aquatic Centre running magnificently around the pitches out there. I had an hour and I went out to the National Aquatic Centre to the sports grounds around it. I think it was February of last year, the annual run. And I go out and I was running around and I saw these. I think there's Lee Keegan. It was a Wednesday night. It was a Wednesday night before Dublin played Mayo in the league in Croke Park. And Mayo had come up and trained, because there were so many players based in Dublin, they'd come up and they trained in the National Aquatic Centre. There were more than 30 players out on the field playing a full match, length and breadth. It was a great game. Great game of football.
Right.
There were maybe four players on the sideline.
Internal training session.
Internal training session. And it was being videoed. There were at least 10 support staff around everything. And there was another bunch of players, the Killian O'Connors and that, who were coming back from injury in the gym. So that's a panel of more than 40.
Yeah.
All in Dublin for an evening with all of that involved, and all had to be fed, presumably. And I know that there are volunteers in that thing who don't get paid for anything.
Yeah.
But that is an expensive operation. And that's a Wednesday night before a league game in February. So what is the story all across the place?
Well, famously, Tipperary needed another bus for their support staff for the All-Ireland final. It was like one for the staff and one for the team. Or at least that's what they said.
Kildare footballers for a long time, that's the way it was.
Yeah, and it didn't actually end up benefiting them in the long run. Like, I don't know what the Kildare footballing identity is. It seems to be to pay an outside manager to come and, you know, whatever... over the three decades, I'm not singling out the current one, but like, what is our identity as a football county? Like, who are we? What do we stand for? We stand for a falling down St. Connolly's Park and great underage footballers who then disappear because there's no strategy behind it.
It is one of the great enigmas for anyone who ever sees Kildare club football or goes and plays against Kildare teams. And who sees Kildare under 18 and under 20 teams. And the power and pace with which they play, how many skillful, quality footballers they produce, the number of club players and the number of schools teams.
Yeah.
And then something happens.
Yeah. And I think that this all comes down to that. And it's like, it's sustainability is actually...
Yeah, it's the key word in this.
Yeah.
And it is a buzzword for the moment, right?
But there's nothing sustainable about getting an outsider to come in for a year and a half, flake everybody and then go away again.
Like, not if you don't have the structures behind it. There is nothing wrong with somebody coming in into a structure that's properly organised, but the idea that this you put in, you do the top layer of the cake first.
And that's it, yeah.
That's just not going to happen.
Yeah, and so Kildare is just a microcosm of what is happening in loads of other counties around the place. Like, so your takeaways are that you're positive about the person who's at the helm and having a vision. What are the other... quick challenges that before.
Okay, so I want to line out two things. There's a brilliant sentence in this where Tom Ryan takes on the idea of the role of the club, right? And he's a great line on it. He said that he himself believes that this idea of the primacy of the club is more of an aspiration or a statement of intent than an inalienable fact. Inalienable, I can't say that fact. Now, did you ever think you would see a leading member of the GAA acknowledge the fact that this is an aspiration of a state or a statement of intent rather than an illegal fact about the centrality of the club? Because, of course, it's a statement of reality that the thing has become skewed. Mm. And it's great to see that set out clearly. Where I absolutely diverge from Tom Ryan on it is when he talks about the ticket price increases, which were fundamental, by the way, to the rise in revenue.
Yeah.
I know there were more people who went to the games, and I suppose he uses... that more the fact that more people went to the games to talk about the well-received ticket price increases last year. Now, I've never seen ticket prices for anything well-received.
No.
But these ticket prices last year were outrageous, the increases on them. They and I'll give you an idea of how outrageous they are. Okay, there was €10 on an All-Ireland final ticket, €5 on a semi-final ticket, €5 on an All-Ireland qualifier, which nobody is going to, €5 on Division 1 and Division 2 football matches. Now, we can say that they're okay in themselves, they're not massive. But if you're going with, say, there's a couple of you going to a game. That's where you very quickly rack up costs. And the basic fact of it is the All-Ireland final is now 30% more expensive than it was during the Celtic Tiger. And Division 1 league matches are now twice the price that they were. I mean, we fundamentally accept that the country lost a run of itself during the Celtic Tiger. And we're way ahead of them prices-wise.
Yeah.
And there is a myth about the GAA, and the myth of the GAA is sport for all. And the truth of it is, and anybody who's involved in a club in Dublin understands this. It may be slightly different in country areas. But if you're involved in a club in Dublin, you are paying enormous registration fees for that club, for to be a member of a club. And in certain areas, you can be looking at, you registering a kid and it's €200 plus. That is not sport for all.
For, like, for once they get it out of minis, is it?
Yes. No. Once you get them into under eights or under tens, it begins to go.
Right.
And it really goes. And the idea, those ticket prices, it is very, very expensive to go to matches now. If you have to travel and do all of that. And it was just a misstep in the middle of to talk about the well-received ticket price increases.
Okay.
There was a couple of other things, like the women's organisation, and their view to whether or not they come inside the organisation or not.
Yeah, and the one club model, 40% of clubs have signed up to the one club model, which basically gives parity of esteem within the club to ladies Gaelic football, to camogie, and to the GAA. 40% have signed up, another 40 are on the way to signing up. There is no word of the other 20%. I would love to know what the story is. That 20% of
no,
other clubs.
Not doing it, lads.
Not doing it. And it is that thing. I come back to that point of sport for all. If it's sport for all, it wasn't sport for all for the GAA for many, many, many years because it was sport for the male all.
Yeah.
But not for
sport
women.
For the lads.
Left right. Sport for lads. Women left absolutely on the margins. And GAA clubs are being dramatically improved by the ongoing revolution, in which sees women take a more central role within the association.
Yeah, and we had the Camogie Association in talking about their Manal programme, which is trying to get more female mentors, which is the next wave that's going to actually completely transform how this looks.
Yes, but the Camogie and the Association, I'll take the example of Dublin here, the Camogie and the Association and the Ladies Gaelic Football Association would also want to get their own house in order and get a house in order very swiftly because the manner in which they treat girls in Dublin, for example, is outrageous. And I'll give you an example. In the under 13, under 14, under 15 and so on championships, they set out a calendar of play which means that girls can play football on a Saturday and the following day go out and play a camogie match on a Sunday. And they're set fixtures, league fixtures which matter, and championship fixtures which matter week after week. Now there's absolutely no code of best practice which will tell you that that's fine.
Playing a game 2 days in a row?
Yeah.
Right. How do you fix it though? Is it week on, week off? Is that the answer?
Yes, it's really simple.
Right.
Set a calendar of play, sit down, agree it.
Is that
revolutionary?
It is, yeah, it is. That's the thing. It's like getting everybody around the table. But the other aspect of this, which we haven't talked about, is the lands in Clonliffe. So apparently they're going to put the LGFA and the Camogie Association in the same building in Clonliffe beside a couple of pitches. So that in itself might be revolutionary. Everybody's going to be able to walk across the corridor and go, what's your fixtures? Now that's at central level, so obviously the local level has to filter down. But
these guys know each other already, Ger. This should not be difficult to do. This requires, and it comes down to one basic thing: looking after kids.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that. Look after the kids properly.
We've obviously had a very interesting election over the last while, interesting election campaign. I know you've had a look at all of the manifestos of the various parties. I'd say some of that was hard work and some of it was like, oh, look, I blinked there and I missed that reference to sport in your manifestos. What did you find and what would actually be an ideal scenario at the end of this for where sport sits within the hierarchy of Irish government?
If you look at I read all the manifestos for the all the parties before the election, and it's completely understandable that sport plays a minor part in the manifesto. So we have to be realistic here. While sport is central to our world in very many respects, we also have to say that in the hierarchy of things that need to be done in the country, sport fits into housing in the sense of the provision of sports fields, of playgrounds, of basketball courts, and as and skating parks and everything. Yeah. Or both urban and rural. It fits in to what we need to do with housing. It's dependent on transport to get to very many places. It requires a proper education system, which is properly funded and isn't given to granting enormous sums of money to elite fee-paying schools and privileging their needs above everything else. It also has a part to play in health. So sport fits kind of everywhere, but in an entity of itself, it is given relatively little space. But out of these manifestos, there is the makings of a reasonable policy and a reasonable idea. And you can see the ideologies of the various parties and their differences coming out in the things. Like the Greens, for example, want to promote youth and child-friendly water sport to encourage awareness of our maritime heritage. That's one of the things that the Greens want to do, as you would expect. And they have four basic principles for their sport policy: improving health, developing communities, enhancing social inclusion, and participating in nature. And it couldn't be a Green manifesto without saying this. And I have to admit, I agree this, and it's going to drive sports people nuts. But they're talking about the importance for kids of low stakes participation. And that is that they will encourage limitation of scorekeeping and record taking and all of that. Now, that's fine to a point.
Yeah.
It's fine to a point. There needs to be a mixture of both that and seriously competitive sport, because kids love competition too. You can't just give everybody a medal. Like, it just doesn't...
No, but the kids know. Like, they end up competing within the games.
Exactly.
Even when there's no score cap, they keep scoring themselves. So, like...
But the point of it is to create a sporting or recreational culture.
Yeah.
Where if you want to play...
There's competition over there. There's no competition here. Everybody does this, and you can all go over there if you want to.
And you're and you're not just standing in a tracksuit running on with the water for somebody else. That's so that principle. I agree, but the Greens don't really have any policies beyond a broad statement of desire.
This is, we'll fill this bit in later.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not central to what they wish to do. Solidarity, people before profit, want more physical activity in schools. They want better fruit and veg in schools. They want to create, and this is where we get the ideological part, they want to create more publicly owned gyms and pools, and I fundamentally agree with that. But the reality of it is, if councils aren't able to build houses at the moment, they're not building gyms and pools. What I would argue is that when in the new building, which is now inevitably going to happen, in local areas, that publicly owned gyms and pools and recreational spaces,
apartment complexes,
like they talk about the importance of tracks around the place and of skate parks and of playgrounds and having funds for that, and that's exactly right. It's exactly right. The best part of Fianna Fáil's manifesto, I would argue, the best part of their entire manifesto in terms of how it's set out and what it's done is their anti-gambling, proposals for taking on gambling, and every single party would do well to take on what they wish to do. They wish for the establishment of a
commission,
a gambling regulating commission, exactly, and just sort out this issue of when you can gamble, how you can gamble, how you can look at how companies deal with problem gamblers and everything to do with that world, which is entirely regulated, unregulated.
Yeah,
not entirely unregulated, but it's largely unregulated.
Yeah. Some of their proposals suggested, it seemed to me, was going to be driving you to use accounts from... It seemed that there was a way to circumnavigate some of the issues that they were coming up with. So the gambling regulator, if there is going to be one, needs to have proper teeth.
Yes.
So you can't just say, look, you can't sign up to accounts that are based on servers in Ireland. You can do the same thing on a server in Malta or Gibraltar. And so
yes,
it just needed to be thought through to that next level, I thought.
Yes, absolutely agree. But it was the best of anything that anybody came out with. It was the largest step forward of anything. And I agree. And people will always find ways around this.
Yeah.
But it was a starting point. They did talk about a sports capital programme and a playground fund and 25 million extra spending in schools, which it's very hard to disagree with, but you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
Labour Party talked about using a new betting levy to fund investment in sport. The Labour Party did what was obviously... the thing that nobody wanted anyone to do, in that they actually offered costed serious proposals and thoughtful proposals on what you could do, and it went. They just, like everything they did, they should have just clearly picked a number out of the sky and run with it, because that seems to be the way things work. But they actually worked on how they should do it. They had coherent proposals for women participation in the governing bodies of sporting organisations, and most importantly, they talked about the reorganisation of government departments and the creation of a better structure where sport would sit. Mm. Why does sport sit with transport and tourism beyond the fact that it's an afterthought? And in the last government, it was so clearly an afterthought when you had a government minister who was not in any way, not, it's not clear that he knew anything about transport or tourism either, but he certainly knew nothing about sport and how it would operate, and he had no interest in it really when it comes down to it.
Yeah.
And you're left with a junior minister, and to be a junior minister in a senior department is just...
pointless.
Well, where are you going?
Yeah.
So the Labour Party proposed the introduction of communities, art and tourism, arts, heritage, community development, all of that within one department. And that just seems to me to make sense. It's a new government department which goes across all of these various strands. It seems to me to make more sense. And I think that's one thing you could take from the Labour Party manifesto, is that broader structure. Now, the Sinn Féin manifesto talked about increasing spending on sports and recreation, increasing the sports capital programme, and then talked about sport, the importance of sport in a post-conflict revolution society, which was kind of interesting. And it made nice noises around class and gender and geography. And it probably focused more of all on what it called working with all sports bodies to support the creation of All-Ireland teams and leagues wherever possible. And it also wants to support elite athletes. Now, in none of this, there's aspiration set out and no plan. Just, and that's fine. It's a manifesto. It's fine to a point. But this idea of supporting All-Ireland teams. So what are the non-All-Ireland teams?
Football.
So how do you do that?
Seize the six counties, roll your tanks in on the lawn in Windsor Park. Is that it?
Well... I'm asking this as a serious question.
Right.
I am asking this as a serious question. And my serious question is this. If you want a United Irish soccer team, or you want a United Ireland in general, what does that look like? And how do you get there?
We've got like 30 seconds left here, and you've just asked the biggest, most fundamental question that we have been unable to answer as a country for 100 years. What does it look like? It looks like building some shared understanding. It means building a trust with people who fundamentally don't trust us, and not being triumphalist when you get that moment of power. It means not shouting up the rah the first opportunity that a camera is put in front of you. It means not lying about that afterwards, like, oh, I didn't realise we were being... like, it's that kind of stuff. It's explaining the fundamentals of what it means to be Irish without defining us as not British. It means like these are the shared heritage that we have almost exactly the same DNA with a tiny little kink that's different, and yet that's the bit that separates us. It means not concerning ourselves with the difference between transubstantiation and whatever the other thing is. Like, none of that stuff actually matters. It means being friends with your neighbours. That's that for me, and building an Ireland off the back of that, and then saying let's play football together.
That took you a little bit more than 30 seconds, which is a bit disappointing with you, but it is exactly right. And how does singing "Come Out Ye Black and Tans" help create an All Ireland soccer team? How does it help create a United Ireland? If there is a United Irish soccer team, what is the emblem on the jersey? What is the anthem that is played beforehand? What is the flag that is flown before matches? What does any of this look like? And how do you intend to get there? Or is it simply a numbers game?
It's very interesting. We had Cormac Moore in a couple of months ago talking about his new book about partition. And he said that actually what it came down to in the splitting of the two football organisations was actually internal politics rather than the politics of the country, which is kind of very fitting with the last year we've had with the FAI and all the internal politics there, that perhaps the most complicated issue is once you take Jura's ideal on a United Ireland, is actually getting through and wading through the mud of the internal politics that exists and the clinging onto power in the IFA and the FAI that I'd imagine would exist.
Well, I agree with that to a point, but it was all the context is the wider political context. So it's not just that the people don't get on. Like, why did... By the way, the GAA, like for rugby, rugby is an All-Ireland organisation, but for huge swathes of the country for a long time until professionalism, rugby had no relevance because it was associated with a very particular class or professional things. Yeah. The GAA is an All-Ireland organisation once you're of a very, but not if you're loyalist.
Yeah.
So the GAA has a lot of work to do itself. And it is doing work, in fairness, but it's a lot of work to go.
Yeah. All right. Look, we are out of time. Is there one last point you want to make on the manifestos?
I would say that even if you do all of this, the relationship with Sport Ireland has to be clear what you are trying to do here.
And who's in charge.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Paul, that's great. We'll definitely come back to that. What would a United Ireland football team look like and how we might get there?
OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Celebrate love with a special gift.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.